And here they come.
Okey-dokey-o. Hello, everybody. I always feel like I should be saying good morning, Vietnam. My favorite comedian, Robin Williams, right? So if you're new to what we do here, this is our Thursday bi-monthly Q&A situation that we started really at the outset of COVID almost 2 years ago. And what we do here is what it sounds like. I'm here basically to respond to questions. I always start with questions that have been submitted in writing. And then if the person who asked the question happens to be here and wants to come on and elaborate, always better to do that because then I can have a little back and forth and maybe tease out some of the nuances. But while I'm answering the questions that came in, you're more than welcome to ping some in the chat column. Also, if you want to make an offering, it doesn't have to be just me responding to questions. If you have something you want to offer, that sort of thing, this is kind of an open platform for that. And then obviously you can hit the reaction column button on the bottom, raise your hand, ask a question live. Like I mentioned, that's always just a tad bit better because then I can engage in a little bit more clarity with the questions. And so with that said, I'm just going to jump right in because we, as usual, we had a number of quite good ones here. So let me just hold on, ping into the ones here. Yeah, two computers here. We got to help me out a little bit. Okay, here we go. Okay, this one's from Pam. So in your book, Preparing to Die, which is my second book. And by the way, just so you know, we are using this book to act as a template for a program that I've actually been crafting for years. We're going to be calling it's going to be a 9-month intensive training program, starting probably in a month or two as we finish up the preparation. It's going to be part of an umbrella organization that we're calling the Preparing to Die Institute. And the first thing is going to be a 9-month Preparing to Die program with like 100 hours of training material and guest interviews. It's a whole big deal thing. We've been working on this for years and it's pretty close to being launched. With famous last words, with that said, it'll probably take another month or two. But stay tuned for that. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be an ongoing cohort, limited in size, that's going to give people literally everything they need to know. So stay tuned on that. I'm pretty psyched about this one. Okay, so in this book, Preparing to Die, you mentioned that as one dies, it is best to pull out all the tubes and artificial stuff for a pure dying process. Yes. I'm just going to be because some of these questions are a little bit longer, I'm just going to pause and run a little commentary as I go through them. Yes, that's true, but I don't think I said pull out all the tubes and unplug everything. The idea is this kind of titrating of the death experience, not too tight, not too loose, where if you're too much pain, that's too tight, that can predispose you towards certain states that are a little bit less than auspicious. So this is where things like palliative care, titrating narcotics, morphine, that stuff, you don't have to get rid of all that. You just have to balance it. But at the same time, if you don't have some of the tubes and whatnot, then there's just too much pain involved. So you want to dance between being too drugged up, that's too loose, and being in too much pain, that's too tight. And that's what the palliative care physicians are for. And palliative care providers. And that's also what your advanced directives are for and your executors, the people who can implement this for you. And so you want to have this pretty clearly in your advanced directives. So you want to have a fairly lucid death experience, not too tight, not too loose. And carefully crafted advanced directives and assertions by executors and really sensitive caregivers, they go a long way with this. But the idea here also, yeah, what I argue about it, or write about in this section of the book, is artificial life support, I think is often appropriately named, artificial life versus authentic death. And so at a certain point, it's ridiculous. The billions upon billions of dollars that are spent unnecessarily to sustain life, because the medical profession and many people think that death is a defeat. So that's worth a running commentary. So question, how might one look at dying with other items that have been placed inside one's body during life support systems, such as pacemakers, hip replacements, et cetera? Is the key to detach from our bodies? Yes, Pam, that you hit it right on the head. That's the key. And I'll say a little bit more about this because you just nailed it. To start this attachment as we age, absolutely. So I'll run commentary on all this. We all love our bodies and have a personal connection, literally. I was a professional ballet dancer. My body was my instrument. Yeah, so the key here, Pam, this is a good one, actually. This goes pretty deep. The key is to let go on our terms, to whatever extent we can, before we are forced to let go on death's non-negotiable, uncompromising terms. And that's why I frequently these days talk about death. And actually, parenthetically, Alyssa's pinging up. There should be two links. The only promo for the session is two links coming up. One is for a really cool death and dying program that I'm doing with Menla and a bunch of somewhat remarkable other speakers. And then the Bardo Dharma Talk program that I'm doing with Bob Thurman at Menla at the end of February as well. So interestingly enough, the only two things I'm plugging are death related to this death business. So I often refer to death these days as a wrathful form of liberation, that you will return to the natural state, the awakened state, when you die, according to the non-dual wisdom traditions. The question is not the experience. The question is the recognition. And so we will do ourselves a great deal of good if we can, in fact, like you're saying, start this detachment as we age. That's what the aging process is inviting and then eventually commanding. In Tibetan, the word is nundro. Aging is a nundro, a preliminary practice for death, where you're being forced, invited, and then forced to let go, right? Eventually you're losing everything. You're losing hearing capacity, skin texture, cognitive abilities, muscle mass, muscle tone. I mean, just if you're over 50, just look at what's happening, right? Take a good hard look in the mirror. It's already happening. It starts really around age 24 when you really stop the full apex of the growth cycle. So death is nature's way to invite you to let go before you're forced to. And so this is actually a really big deal, not only practically, because this will remove all this unnecessary suffering. If we're attached, we will suffer in direct proportion to our attachment. And some people say, oh, you know, this Buddhist thing, I remember there was a story, a true story we're sharing, where Trungpa Rinpoche, who one of my main teachers taught a lot about, wrote some really brilliant stuff on the Bardos. He was teaching a program in Crestone, and somebody raised his hand and went on this little rant about, oh, you Buddhists, you're so depressing. All you talk about is, you know, old age and sickness and suffering and death. And he went on and on, just kind of railing against the kind of pessimism, so to speak, of Buddhism. And Trungpa Rinpoche listened completely unflappable, equanimous, and basically simply said at the end, old age, sickness, death, and suffering are not Buddhist inventions. This is just reality. We may not like it. And sometimes I get slack from people. It's like, oh, it's just like, oh, it's so whatever. Well, sorry, there's gravity. I can't do anything about gravity. There's death. Nobody can do anything about death. But you can't prepare. And so for me, this has been a large part of my life. I look very closely at, hey, in fact, this is such a central question that really, this is the question that led to the Buddha's enlightenment. Under the Bodhi tree 2,600 years ago, he started at death. He started at the end. And he worked his way back in a very sophisticated delinking deconstruction process, deconstructing the phenomena of death to its fundamental ideology or cause, which is ignorance. And so really, in a very profound way, the entire seed of the Buddhist tradition and other wisdom traditions as well is born from the deep reflection and contemplation on impermanence and death. And so the sooner we get the grip on this, the better, the more we can actually prepare, because otherwise what constitutes an ungraceful exit is grasping, holding on, attachment. And so literally, what are we, literally, not metaphorically, what are we literally the most attached to? This form, this body. We're literally attached to this body. And so learning how to differentiate from exclusive identification with form, body, that's what ego is, that is a colossal part of the path. Letting go, releasing, dying to our attachment to form, most archetypally represented as attachment to body. And so this is of such centrality that when we die, again, I could talk about this for hours. In fact, that's what I'll be talking about with Bob Thurman in the program. So I'll just ping a little bit. When we die, what takes place is the unconscious mind takes control, the samskaras, habit patterns. That's what dictates the dying process. And of all the samskaras that we have, it's called bhava samskara. The heaviest of all the samskaras is the habit for habituation, the habit for habitation itself. Our belief in form, our exclusive identification with form. And so there is so much to say about this that fundamentally, this is where the colossal teachings on emptiness come into play. That when we die, we take on existence because we believe in existence. We take on form because we believe in form. We take on a body because we believe we're somebody. It's really that Newtonian. It's that causality. It's that black and white. You will take on a body involuntarily, driven by karmic impulse, because you believe you're somebody. So the entire path is really kind of death in slow motion. Differentiate from these levels of gross form into really, really subtle forms, because those are the forms that do not dissolve. Those are the forms that do not die. And so your question here, Pam, I'll let her go for now, because this is all the Bardo teachings are set around this question, or all the teachings on emptiness are set around this question. But to come back to your point, what you said is really the core thing. Things like pacemakers, hip replacements, all that, really just put that aside. That doesn't really matter. I doubt you're attached to your hip replacement or your dentures or whatever. I mean, maybe. What are you really attached to? Literally, your body. So you paint it, Pam. The key is to detach from exclusive identification with body. Now, that doesn't mean we should dismiss our body and do all these super crazy aesthetic type things. No. Treasure the form, but don't identify with it. Love without attachment. I just came back from the gym. It's one reason I was a few minutes late. I'm sitting there denying death playfully by working out. I often say, health is just the slowest way to die. And so I still exercise. I eat well. I do everything I can to keep this form alive as long as I possibly can. I'm not saying that, but I'm also extremely aware of how identified I am with this thing and how I will suffer in direct proportion to that level of identification. So remember, that's what ego is. Ego is exclusive identification with form. Ego, as Freud said, ego is first and foremost a body ego. So start by letting go of this. So this is a great question. I'll let it go for now because this seeds an entire week of teachings. So that's a great one. Okay. From Barry. Oh, my dear friend, Barry Sponder. Wonderful. One of my favorite people. What book or books do you recommend for explaining the symbolism found in the Wheel of Life, Tanka, the Bhava Chakra? Oh, okay. Well, this ties in a little bit to the previous question in that the Bhava Chakra, the Wheel of Life, which is this incredibly sophisticated depiction. I often have it behind me and what I have a huge Tanka. That I unfurl behind me when I teach on this topic. I obviously don't have it with me because I didn't get these questions in time. But the reason I mention this, and then I'll tell you, Barry, where you can go, is that what the Buddha actually, what ends up being depicted in the Wheel of Life is in fact this 12-step detox, this 12-step deconstruction process. The contents of enlightenment, the Buddha, if you remember the Wheel of Life held by Yama, the Lord of Death, the outer rim of the Wheel of Life are 12 separate little links, vignettes, that represent the 12 links of causation, of dependent origination, of which everything arises. And it starts with the first nadana, ends with death. And so this is the depiction. So Barry, there's a fair amount of literature here. Whoa, you know, a couple of my favorites. Francesca Fremantle, if you haven't read it yet, Barry, you got to get this book. Luminous Emptiness, Understanding the Tibetan Book of the Dead. She's a rock star. She's an amazing individual. And this is an unbelievable book. And what I like about Francesca, the first half of the book is all about the doctrinal preparation to understand the Book of the Dead, which is pretty impenetrable if you don't have the prep. And she has one chapter devoted to the 12 lakes, the 12 Nidanas, the Wheel of Life. And what I really like about her exposition is most people go from one to 12. She goes from 12 to one, exactly what the Buddha did when he woke up. And I'm pretty sure she has some succinct teachings there on the iconography and the symbolism. If not, other sources would be literally a book. I think it's called The Meaning of Life by His Holiness Dalai Lama. That's another one. One of my favorites is actually by a Thai master, Payutto, Paytto. I think it's literally called just dependent origination. Trungpa Rinpoche also wrote, I can't remember where it's in the collected works, but I don't know where. He also wrote a really pretty brilliant exposition on the 12 links, but I can't source that into collected works. It is in one of those. I'd have to kind of go through them to figure that one out. Those are the ones that immediately come to mind, my friend. There are others. Other authors are working on it. Gary Buck is writing a really interesting one or two volume set on the 12 links, but that won't be out for a little while. There's a ton out there, but those are the ones that come to mind first and foremost, Barry. And if I can think of the volume, if I can dig it up, I'll just email you where in the collected works Trungpa Rinpoche talks about it, because I know he wrote on it as well. Okay, here we go. So this is from Jeremy. Thanks so much for everything you do. You're welcome. I'm a student of Buddhism under Lama Shenpen. Ooh, very good. So that's Lama Shenpen Hokum, I guess. She's awesome, if that's who you're referring to. She's terrific. In fact, last time I saw her was actually with Francesca in London, if that's who you're referring to. So I mostly follow the Mahamudra Dzogchen traditions. Excellente. I was wondering if you could share or know of any specific prayer that one could recite upon awakening during the night before going back to bed for lucidity. I do pray to Guru Rinpoche and Amitabha, who I feel a strong devotion to. That's awesome. But I do not have any specific prayer or chant that I could recite. I'm finding it hard to stay awake for long upon awakening before drifting off again. So I think a specific text or prayer would be useful to keep the mind a bit more vivid. Yes, there is some stuff, Jeremy, and I will see in the course of when people are coming up if I can find it. I have a prayer, I'm quite certain, and I just pulled this off the shelf before I sat down, that comes from actually Guru Rinpoche. So there is some liturgy around this. I have several. Again, I didn't see these questions in time to really do the legwork to pull this off for you, but I'll see if I can track this down. If not, promise, top of the list for next time. I'll just have to do a little legwork. I do a particular prayer that comes from the six yogas of Naropa, but unfortunately, these are things I can't share. They require what's called a lung, and I don't have the capacity to do that in this format. But what you're saying here is really great, Jeremy, to have some type of liturgy, either official. Or here's what I would do, my friend, and I did this when I was in my long retreat. This is no kidding. I created my own prayer. So I did the classic one from the six yogas because that's traditional. I memorized it. But then I actually created my own. I mean, why not? Why not write your own aspiration prayer? The only thing you have to do is start every sentence with the word may, right? May I. But somewhat lighthearted, but also I'm very actually quite serious here. Write your own prayer. Because the words, you know, it's the feeling that's important. The words are just carriers for the feeling. And so I can dig up some of this traditional stuff, but I am not kidding here at all, Jeremy, when I say empower yourself. Write your own prayer, write down your own aspiration that comes from your heart. it'll have as much juice because it's being propelled by your belief and your devotion and compassion or whatever. Trust me on this, it will have as much power as something official. And if you want to get some kind of footing for this, read the parable of the tooth. It's about this woman who really believed that this particular tooth was the tooth of the Buddha, and it wasn't. But her belief was so powerful that it overrode the physicality that this was not the Buddha's tooth. And she had so much devotion and respect and love and care for this relic that it actually created this kind of blessing power as if it was the Buddha's tooth. So read that parable, and I am not kidding when I say empower yourself and write your own aspiration, write your own prayer. But with that said, I'll see if I can dig up. There's several traditional ones. I'll see if I can grab those for you. Okay. From Tim. Hey, Tim. Our whole individual life has been made up of a composite of our experiences. Indeed. As I get older, these experiences seem more and more dreamlike and thought-like in nature. Excellent, my friend, because they are dreamlike. They are empty in nature. That's what emptiness means. There's no inherent reality to them. They're just as ephemeral as a puff of smoke. Back to him. We know that thoughts are changing and impermanent and therefore not ultimately real. Yes, these are all expressions of emptiness. Impermanence is the expression of emptiness. What are your thoughts on those life experiences that made us what we are as individuals? Okay, what happens to them when we die? I would like to think of them being stored in some collective sense rather than just disappearing and perhaps being of some use to others also. I appreciate anything you can share about this topic. Okay, Tim. It depends on who you ask. So here's the deal with the storage tracing, the storage thing. This is a little interesting, actually. What happens to them when they die? What happens to our thoughts and those life experiences that make us up as individuals? Well, if the thought actually arises, Tim, and it self-liberates, it's not stored. It doesn't leave a trace. There's no karmic residue. It just arises and dissolves like a campfire spark. Bingo. No trace, no storage, gone. However, most thoughts don't do that. Most thoughts we either repeat. I heard one study that says 90% of what we thought think today is exactly what we thought yesterday. Look at your own mind to see the truth of that. And so we're constantly recycling this kind of recycling process where we're just reliving these loops. Those puppies get buried. They get buried in your substrate consciousness. They get buried in your alaya, vijnana. And that's literally called the storehouse consciousness. Perhaps of being some use to others. I have to chuckle here a little bit, my friend. I'm afraid not. In fact, they may not be of that much use to you, but they're, and again, this depends on the tradition. I'll talk about a different school that has a slightly different track on this. So I'm not talking from personal experience here. I'm talking about the traditions and what they say. In this Buddhist tradition, the traces, gosh, there's so much to say here. The traces that we leave are really of no benefit to others, unless those traces somehow are beneficial and therefore are helpful traces. They're called bakchak or bijas that then get implanted into our next mind stream that then we could use for the benefit of ourselves and other in that next incarnation. But in terms, if I'm understanding you, do these kind of go into like some collective pool? No, not according to the Buddhist tradition. They just reside in your own Santana, your own mind stream, your own substrate consciousness. They're not really a benefit to others in that regard. However, with that said, there are different traditions. Certain Hindu schools that talk about the Akasha, that talk about the Akashic records. And this, again, this is an open question for me. I'm a little bit more agnostic on this. There's some of it that does make sense to me. That's also connected to what's called the zero point energy field in physics. There's some correlations made between those two. And according to this view, the Akasha stores stuff. Now, what exactly it does store is a little bit above my pay grade. I can't really say, but I do know that according to that view, and you might want to look at, Erwin Laszlo wrote a book on this. If you just Google Akasha, A-K-S-H-A, or Akashic Field, you'll get up a ton of literature on this. I know a little bit about it, but just enough to be dangerous. So I can't speak with too much authority about that. But one thing that I think may be worth looking at here, Tim, is this: what comes to mind, and I don't know if this is something that will land with you, is this whole notion that Ernst Becker, this wonderful anthropologist, wrote about in a Pulitzer Prize winning book that was massively influential, called The Denial of Death. This is an amazing book. And in this book, he coins this whole notion of immortality projects and how it is that either through our children or through our legacy or through our books, through our arts, through whatever, we want to leave some trace, some record of our existence. And you can see this going back all the way to Ramses and the Egyptian tradition. I mean, just look at history, Napoleon. I mean, you know, I want to leave my mark on reality. Well, we might want to take a look at the motivation behind that, right? I mean, isn't that just ego speaking? So that's a little bit what comes to mind, is like, why do you want to leave a legacy? Open question. I mean, what is it in that department that is of some interest to you? So I can speak a little bit on the Buddhist end. If a thought arises, self-liberates, leaves no trace whatsoever, no karma created. If the thought's repeated, actually that's what creates identity. Identity comes from the root idem, which means literally over and over. And so those types of patterns, they have colossal impact. What happens to them when they die? Well, those are the ones that become the samskaras. Those are the ones that then form you. So you might want to take a look at that. What types of thoughts are you continually reiterating, repeating? What type of identity are you clothing yourself with over and over? If it's noble, if it's good, then that's great. Then that's good karma. That will take good care of you. And that's actually really good. So not all this stuff is bad. You can have, you know, living your life with loving kindness, bodhicitta, kindness, service of others. That's colossally important. So that's a part that does sustain. That does maintain some type of momentum, some type of push. But anyway, yeah, I'll let that go because I can't really speak too much about the Akasha thing. I do find it interesting in terms of karmic fields and that kind of stuff. It's very interesting, but the Buddhists don't really go there. That's more Hindu territory. Okay, one last one written and then we'll go live. From Anne. Hi, Anne. I'm a practitioner of Ajrayana for 40 years. Very good. Was a student of Trungpa Rinpoche. Terrific. Practiced dream yoga 10 years ago with some success, but let it slide and recently felt called to revisit. Good for you. I reread the book by Stephen LaBerge and I'm keeping a dream diary. Yeah, Stephen's written about 4 at this point, but probably a second book, Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. That's probably the one you're talking about. Doing prompts during the day, falling asleep with intention to become lucid, etc. Good for you. I am noticing that I'm not becoming lucid in my dreams after a month or so of intending to do so, even though I'm following the protocols. I'm recording regular dreams that are chaotic and have a ridiculous, bizarre quality that make no sense at all. Yeah, that's worth just a quick comment. Not all thoughts really carry any impact at all. A lot of thoughts, there's a broad spectrum of thoughts. Dreams. There's a broad spectrum of dreams from neurological noise, which is fundamentally meaningless, all the way to what are called theophantic or these so-called big, super clear dreams. Those are life changers. But the neurological noise dreams, just those are nothing. That doesn't mean they can't be used for the purposes of lucid dreaming and dream yoga, for sure. But whether they carry any import, probably not. Okay, I'm wondering what is up and why is this practice so difficult for me at this time? Oh, and if I had a quarter for every time I was asked this question, I could retire. I'll get back to it a little bit. It's making me wonder if I'm crazy. No, you're not crazy. Well, you're a student of Trungpa Rinpoche, so you follow crazy wisdom tradition. So you're probably a little crazy, but in a good way. Or maybe I have some deep block to work through with dream lucidity at this time. I practice meditation every day, so can't understand why there is such a block to being lucid at night. Until I restarted this practice, I didn't remember many dreams, but now I am keeping a dream diary again. I'm writing down cartoon-like dreams that make no sense. You don't have to write all those down. You just have to remember a couple of dreams. You don't have to chart all that kind of stuff down. Just write the dreams that have some impact, some momentum. It does help at first, Anne, if you want to increase dream recall, yes, to do what you're saying. But at a certain point, that kind of stuff, you can let that go and just strengthen your intention and work with writing down or recording the dreams that have some import. Because otherwise, oh my gosh, you're going to be spending half the morning writing your dreams down. That's not a good use of time. Might it be too disturbed by the chaos in my outer world? That's a really interesting comment. I live in California where there's a lot of tension and unease in the community around the so-called pandemic. Can you provide any insight? Yeah. Oh man, I talk a lot about this, Anne. So I'm going to refer you to a couple of resources so I don't just have to repeat myself. But let me say something about the ending comment here. May I be disturbed by the chaos in my outer world experience at this time? Yes, that could be what part of what's going on. Maybe you can connect this to the Akasha thing, who knows? But this kind of collective milieu of duress and stress and the dark age thing, it definitely has individual effects. It can definitely kind of, you know, it's a little bit like being in that, if you know a little bit about the Pure Land tradition, right? Sukhavati. This relates to the whole Sukhavati principle, because one of the reasons you want to go to a Pure Land is that the environment is so pure. There's so many enlightened beings. There's so many lamas. Just imagine an area where everybody is awake, a lama, a bodhisattva, a Buddha, you name it. You can't help but be positively influenced by that. Well, playing a little bit on words, we don't live in Sukhavati. We live in Dukhavati. We live in the dark age of suffering. And conversely, just as you have high center of gravities that can lift you up, you also have collective low center of gravities, think of where we are right now, that can drag you down, for sure. And this is why, you know, this is why you do protector practices. This is why you engage in protector principle. This is why you have a sangha. This is why you do all these ritualistic things, you know, about setting boundaries and all that stuff. That is, in fact, to work with this kind of negative gravitational effect. So I can't say with any authority how much of an impact this is having on you. That's really almost impossible to say. But is it having an effect? Oh yeah, for sure. And I think on one level, we know this. And there's been some interesting studies, both recently, Deidre Barrett has done some from Harvard. Previously, there's people who did this in relation to dreams around the Third Reich, that they did collective pool statistical analysis of people that are having dreams during these horrific times. And absolutely positively, what a surprise. People were really powerfully negatively affected by what was happening in the world. So for sure. So with you, I might, you know, I don't know where you are with your protector practices. I don't know where you are with your sadhana stuff, setting boundary principles, that kind of thing, mandala. As a Vajrayana practitioner, you can do that. The other stuff, I'm going to refer you to other resources because I've really said a lot about this in other venues. If you look in, if you're a nightclub member in the webinar series early on, there should be descriptions in there. 2, 3, 4, 5 entire webinars devoted to the different types of obstacles. I'm going to refer you to those. And the Harbinger Press book I published last December, the Lucid Dreaming Workbook, I have quite an extensive section in there about working with obstacles. These are the more kind of common traditional obstacles that are really worth paying attention to. And so because the topic is so big and because I've talked about it so many times and so many other different avenues, I'm going to refer you to those avenues with your permission and then leave you with perhaps the new contribution about how the environment, outer environment, can have this really negative effect on us, okay? But don't be discouraged. That's one of the reasons dream yoga is considered advanced, is it takes an advanced attitude to do it and to sustain it. And what makes advanced practitioners advanced and advanced is they never give up. You just keep going. Doesn't matter. Every single day you do your aspirations, you do your practices, you ramp up your formal induction stuff, And so all the things, you know, the other thing that's worth throwing into the mix here, connected to the Wheel of Life issue, is that lucid dreams don't arise in a vacuum. They arise in a dependent originated way. And this is why my approach, if you're at all familiar with it, I go all over the map with my stuff. I talk about all these different vectors and strands that co-conspire to bring about either lucidity or non-lucidity. And that's why this question is not such a simple one to just, oh, there it is, your problem is this. Oy vey. I mean, I'd have to talk to you for 3 hours to figure that out. But usually these things, not usually, lucidity or non-lucidity is brought about in this co-conspiratorial, systemic, holistic way. And so you have to have all these factors into play, starting with Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, you know, that trifecta. Starting with good motivation, starting with good dream recall, starting with induction methods, starting with blah, blah, blah. You get all those puppies in a row, and hey, guess what? Non-lucidity doesn't stand a chance. You're going to have lucid dreams all over the place. So unless you want to come on and ask something specifically around all this, Anne, really great question, but I'm going to refer you to other sources where I riff on that. Okay. So in the meantime, we can turn to some live ones, and I will also scroll through the...
Yeah, there were quite a few that came in through the chat, so...
Yeah, well, let's get a couple of people have been waiting here.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
At least I know one person, and then I'll scroll through here.
There we go.
Oh, is it for Cara? It's me?
Yeah, fire away.
Hey! Let me start my video. Hi, Andrew. It's been a long time. So I had a comment and an offering, maybe a talking point and an offering. So I think since September, I've been doing this Shamatha 8-day workshop with Alan Wallace and Tanya. It's so amazing. But I've just been cycling it. So I've been doing, I guess there are 26 half-hour sessions of meditation. So I've just been doing 2 a day. Perfect. So that's a lot of months of just, I've been in this retreat with them. And something happened recently around a dental thing, which I thought was kind of funny since you were a dentist. Is that I kept going to the dentist because I needed a tooth pulled. I'd let it go to the point and I couldn't get the tooth pulled. I would go to the office, I would set up the appointment, I'd go in the back room and I would say, you know, I just can't do it. And he'd say, okay, well, we'll see you next time. And I did this 3 times. And finally, I said to him, you know, I just don't know how I'm going to do this. So this, why I'm saying this is I finally did have my tooth pulled. But since I've been little, if I can look at something like stitches or any kind of injury, as long as I can visually see it, I relax. So telling me to lay back in a dentist chair is not going to happen. So coincidentally with the meditation, these meditation on the breath, specifically like the Asanga method, and then breathing in at the nostrils. The instruction is very clearly not to visualize parts of the body. So in discussing this tooth thing with a therapist I've been talking with, he said, wait a minute. And he came back and he said, wait, do you mean that you can't unvisualize? Because like if you said to me, focus on the air coming in on the sensation of the air coming in at the nostrils, I would have to work to see my nostrils. And I said, are you kidding? And he said, no. He said, so are you saying that my visual is so coupled to every sensation I have, which also makes sense in blockage of lucid dreaming because I believe what I see. So hard for me to unbelieve the visual. So this all just coincided. And I've been working to decouple the visual, but I'm so surprised that, like, speaking of the reification of this, you know, I'm in my body, this checking every 10,000 times a second. I'm not sure what else to do. I just go through the cycle of meditations with Alan at 2 a day and figure that one day I'm going to know how to do it. And I just try to relax. I try to do less and less and less.
Wow, boy, you threw a lot of noodles against that wall. So which part of this do you want to focus on?
Well, I mean, this decoupling, I mean, it was a revelation to me that, like, I don't know. Okay, here's the mystifying thing. Okay. I can't feel anything. This may not be true, but it happened so fast that I can't even have a physical sensation without an image of it. That is just like astounding to me. So apparently everybody isn't like this. So like, it's like, it's doubly hard for me to uncouple.
Let me ask you something. Part of what comes to mind is actually what the Svatantrika tradition talks about, which is really the, and again, I'm not sure this is what's happening with you, but this is what comes to mind, that basically whatever we really experience is in fact mental. In other words, it's an image of what's actually happening. So the reason I throw this is because, can you tell the difference if what you're having is actually a visualization or more like a mental signature or imprint of what you're actually feeling? Because if it's just a mental imprint of what you're feeling, then that's just the way the mind works. The mind just works in this representative way. So it's not clear to me if that's what you're saying.
Oh, well, that's very interesting because no, I'm not actively, okay. So let's say I'm focusing on the air coming in at my nostrils and I'm only focusing on when the air comes in and goes out just at the rim of the nostril. Well, I find it impossible to feel that sensation without also seeing the nostril.
So then that's the sixth consciousness barging in on one through five. And so I'm curious, have you had a chance in this class with Alan to ask Alan this question or one of the
brands? No, because these are just recordings. So I've just been doing the 8-day retreat like 25 times.
Here's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, I would celebrate, instead of chiding yourself, celebrate the insight that you've noticed the instantaneity, the rapidity of the sixth consciousness to come in and append its almost immediate commentary on the other five consciousnesses. So that in itself is really, that's a really somewhat powerful insight that we rarely, how do they say it? There's no such thing as an immaculate perception. That it's very rare until the mind is actually really kind of processed, the word is Xinjiang, settled, for you in fact to have a completely pure non-conceptual experience. And so the fact that you can actually suss that out, I would do a little high five and say, that's actually pretty cool that you've actually been able to resolve that. That's just what the mind does. The sixth consciousness comes in lightning fast. To either bring a visualization, which is almost immediately followed by a set of commentaries or whatever, the mental consciousness immediately slaps its commentary on top of consciousnesses one through five. That's just what it does.
Okay.
And so the fact that you're actually seeing that is, that's actually no small discovery. And so now what you can do is just simply recognize that. Recognition and liberation are simultaneous, and just let it go. Another sense arises, you bring immediately a lightning strike rapidity of the sixth consciousness comes slapping back in and realize, wow, this is amazing. There's this wonderful term in the Sanskrit, it's called chamatkara, which is this sense of amazement and wonder and awe. And this is really a very interesting comment because, or term, because what it can help you do then is instead of beating yourself up about some seemingly inadequate propensities around these meditations, you can celebrate. You can say, oh my gosh, isn't this amazing? Look how fast my mind is.
Yeah, it did amaze me because it explained why I couldn't get a tooth pulled. If I could have watched him pulling my tooth, I would have been totally fine with it. Been this way since I'm five, like letter watch, you know? Yeah. And so the other thing I guess that's happening too is that when I'm using my mind as the object of meditation, and I am now, I'm so glad he said that pictures are a form of subtle thought because that wasn't differentiated to me before. But now when I can perceive these subtle thoughts, now I label them, you know, I can catch them, but I still name them, which is extraordinary.
You don't have to name them. Just.
No, I don't have to, but my brain is. So I'm wondering, is there a point where I'm gonna where an image will arise where I don't have to name it? That would be beautiful too. Yes.
It's a deconstruction, deautomatization process, and usually what happens is the mind is moving so fast. We don't even know what deautomatization means. We don't realize that we're running on this kind of automatic ignorance process. We all are.
Right.
And so when you start to further slow the mind down with shamatha, eventually you start to see vipassana, so that you're already inserting some vipassana here. So high five on that. You're seeing things that you haven't seen before. Now, eventually when you start to insert some space by slowing down, now, like exactly like you're saying, now you can start to relate to the sixth consciousness crashing in instead. You can relate to it instead of from it. And so, yes, you start initially with a labeling thing. That's fine. Eventually, you'll get to the point where, like I mentioned earlier, the thoughts, even the sensation, the sensation will arise. There may be the immediate kind of allocation of a thought, sixth consciousness onto that. But eventually, with some practice, you will start to notice how that starts to just evaporate. Because it's just going up. It's just, there's nothing there to give attraction.
And actually, in the awareness of awareness meditations that he's giving us, I am having some really beautiful moments where things are disappearing.
Exactly. So, I mean, if you're working with Alan, you're in really great hands.
And I can't believe how, I can never listen enough. And one thing I was having trouble with was my motivation, because he asks at the beginning of every session, and I always forget, you know, the bigger your motivation, and then he gives an example of the bodhisattva, you know, and I can't love everybody yet. So I made up my own. I started with a kernel of love, and I'm hoping that it will grow. But here, my new affirmation is make tracks, which means don't rush, but hurry the fuck up. Leave tracks, do it for others as well as yourself. Follow tracks. Be very sensitive to who's giving you the information, take those and become a tracker. So that's my new aspiration, is to become a tracker.
Love it. I love it. Yeah. As like Milarepa said, hasten slowly.
Right.
I love it.
Thank you.
You know, awesomely cool stuff. And just hang in, you know, just hang in there. Just keep going. I should say, you know, keep going to stop, right? You know, slow down more and more. You'll discover more. You'll have more space in your mind, more space in your heart, and you'll slowly start to notice the decoupling of these, the linking, what's called linking thinking. You'll start to decouple, de-link the sixth consciousness from the running commentary on all these other sense faculties. You actually will improve your perception. So eventually you will have an immaculate perception. But just the fact that you realize the stain, that's half the problem. You know, if you don't even know you have a problem, how are you ever going to solve it? So this is a very subtle problem. And so just the fact that, again, I want to leave you with a pat on your back. Just the fact that you can articulate what you did is no small accomplishment. So good for you, and keep it up. Cool.
All right.
Hey, Myra.
Hello.
Hi there. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too. So there are so many questions. You lately have been on a roll. I mean, you've been just sending so much information at once that it's like whiplash. But anyway, you went really fast with that new program that you're offering at the beginning. When are you giving a little bit more information about that training or certification of all those hours?
Yeah, I was slightly hesitant to even mention it because it's not 100% there, but it's 90% there. And so, I'll say a little bit, but a lot of it is still, it will be released, the whole program, the content, the everything is being offered, hopefully within the next 6 weeks is what we're shooting for. But basically it's going to be, I've been really thinking about doing this literally for like 10 years. About 8 years ago, a very extremely generous friend came up. He just drafted this. It must have taken him 100 hours. This incredibly elegant, articulate description of how we could actually create and craft a completely rigorous, this was before Preparing to Die was even published, preparation for people like you and me and others who are like looking at the end of the station that we're in, the sannyasa phase, and saying, hey, wait a second, I want to be as ready as I possibly can for dying. And so we are now going to implement that through, like I mentioned, over 100 hours of content, a cohort that will be guided with weekly discussion things. It's going to be the most rigorous, systematic thing I have ever done, interviewing experts and blah, blah, blah. So outside of just that initial finger painting,
okay,
there's a lot more to be said on it, but we're pretty
excited. My heart is going really, really fast.
Yeah.
Oh my God, really?
But yeah, we're pretty excited because we've been working on this for years, and it finally is coming together, and we're going to be doling it out starting. Hopefully, our aspiration is to get it kicked off right around the time of the big Manla program at the end of February. But we'll see. So stay tuned. Thanks for your interest, and you'll be the first to know.
Oh, thank you. Second thing, I mean, I want to share a little bit of a dream because I'm curious, but also it seems to me you often tell us that it's such a joke. And I was listening to Kara and her devotion to her practice and how we all can relate to that discipline that she's having in a way and admire it. But it's almost like the more that we seek, every time that we get to a certain level, we just have to stay back and just completely relax. It's almost like you have to let go. It's a contradiction completely, that the more we seek, we can get addicted to the fix that we get with every little nugget of knowledge, but then we just have to let it go. Because it's only in the let it go that you really experience the nature of,
yeah, the mind is your reality. It's true, Mara. It's the juxtaposition, the delicate dance between relative and absolute path, relative and absolute truth. On one level, absolute level, you don't have to do a thing. Just literally, just open, relax. That's it. Done deal. That's over. But for most people, that's a little bit too steep. Not enough stability, not enough insight. So then we have all the relative approaches. That's the path, all the countless different skillful means, the practices, the tools, the teachings that are fundamentally all there to support this fundamental agenda of relaxation and opening, which again, tying us into the death thing, that's what death forces, right? I mean, death, it's a strange little gig. Death forces this ultimate relaxation, this ultimate release, this ultimate opening. And so we work with both those vectors, right? Because most of us don't have that kind of stability. We have to engage the relative laws of causality and karma.
Oh, I lost you.
Habit patterns. So we work with both approaches. We engage both those vectors of the spiritual path. Are you still there? Yes, no, maybe. She may have disappeared.
She's still there. Uh-oh. I don't think she can hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what to do.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me. I'm not sure what happened.
I'm not sure either.
Maybe you can see that. Are we running an otter transcript on this one?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Sorry, Amara. I wish I could, do.
I'll send her a message. Oh, it looks like it kicked her off now.
Yeah, you just completely bumped her. Yeah, I can't hear you either.
I'll send her a message and we'll let her know.
Okay.
All right.
I'm back.
Well, there you are.
Okay. Yes, I do not know. It's just too much electricity coming through. but anyway, I get it. But let me ask you something about a dream that I had. It was a lucid dream, as it was at the beginning, and I'm doing my practices and I'm doing pretty intense. It was kind of dark. And I know that it's not about so much as to the content, but the energy that lasted after that. So I'm in the dream, and all of a sudden I would be having a stroke, and the dream is telling me that I'm going to have a stroke. And my sister says to me, no, I said, well, this is a dream. And I said, no, you have to have it. So I had it and it was kind of strong. So I begin to come out of the dream knowing that I was in the dream. And I know, I said, you have to go back because you are burning those seeds. So just go back in there and whatever it is, now you burned it. And I went there and said, so this is spent. So about 5 minutes later, I wake up. But the energy, not knowing whether I was going to have a stroke or not, or whether my mind is telling me, because what I know about dreams, that could be a possibility. I'm not going there. But the energy of the dream lasted about 5 hours. I would feel it in my head. I would feel it in parts of my body to the point that I said, okay, if I have another symptom, I would have to go to the doctor.
So when you say, when you say energy, be more, can you be more explicit? What do you mean by energy? The feeling tone, positive, negative?
No, I would feel electric things in my head. My feet were light. I would have a current on my head to the point that I thought it could be a TIA. And so I said, well, this is kind of silly. The body could be telling me, and it could be many things. I'm not asking you regarding whether it was a true experience or whether it was a premonition. What I'm asking is that energy that sometimes lasts after a dream in the body, what is the physical part of it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's just, you know, that's the subtle body, right? So when you're in the dream, it's subtle body and subtle mental content. And so that subtle body energy can be opened and released. And that can not only last for 5 hours, that can last a lifetime. I mean, that type of access, something's been opened, something's been released, some skara has been purified. Irrespective, like you said, and I'm not qualified to go into, like, is it a stroke of insight? Is it a stroke of who knows what? I don't really want to go there. But I think the important thing is what you're alluding to, that you can in fact have this kind of opening in your subtle body that can have repercussions in your gross physical body, not just for 5 hours, but for 5 days, 5 years, because there's a lot of energy trapped in the subtle body. I mean, tremendous energy. And so when it opens, you can feel this kind of electrification. You can feel lighter, freer, less burdened, almost lit up. And that's really indicative of these knots being released at the level of the subtle body. So that's what comes to mind around that. That's a pretty cool event.
Yeah, I felt like I put my hands in the socket. I mean, I felt like my feet were not on the ground kind of deal for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's
it's just.
And that's indicative of all the energy that we actually have trapped in our bodies. I mean, we are so, there's so much energy. It's like a nuclear fission in our bodies, all trapped up. Lifetimes of energy is trapped up. And so as we start to engage in the spiritual path, sometimes serendipitously, sometimes directly with very specific targeted practices, sometimes a combination of those two, subtle body processes are open, relaxed, and all this thermonuclear energy that's within you, whoa, guess what? Now it starts to come up. And so that's, you can say Hindu language, expression of Kundalini being released, is prana, lung. You can throw off 100 different names on it. But fundamentally, this process of opening, releasing, and being electrified, lit up by that, that's another really high five event. So cool for you.
I don't know. It's good. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Right.
Hey, Keenan.
There we go.
Hi, Andrew.
Good to see you. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see you. I had a quick question I wanted to kind of check in with you.
Okay.
During meditation, like open awareness meditations, I often tend to, after about 15, 20 minutes, tend to enter into a zone of like relaxation, and a place that seems like sleep. It is not sleep, because I come out of it at the end of the meditation and I have awareness. Let's say if I'm following a guided meditation, I know that I'm hearing, but I have no memory or recall of what I heard. And I guess my question is that I feel maybe there is an element of like lethargy or dullness there.
Yeah.
And if that is something, is there something I can
do?
Yes. It's been happening for quite a long time.
Good comment. Good question. That's a really common consequence of open awareness, especially up front, you know, because you're with this practice, which is an unbelievably powerful practice. You're in a certain way, you're inviting a really spacious quality of mind, almost like mixing your mind with space, right? And so the near enemy of that spaciousness is spaciness. And so the near enemy altogether of open awareness is lethargy, more so than excitation. Excitation is a principle enemy of the referential practices, form-based meditations. The non-referential practices, which open awareness is the first, the propensity for error then comes to be exactly like you said, laxity. And so what you can do there, I think what you're feeling is exactly right. The mind is entering almost a liminal space, almost a hypnagogic kind of space. And so what you can do there are several things. One is, I'm not sure what you're doing with your eyes and whatnot, but you can raise your gaze, focus your attention, because if your gaze is really open and diffused, that can initially create a kind of diffused laxity kind of response to the mind. So you can focus your gaze a little bit more directly. You can also look at your posture, because you may find that when you're doing it, your posture is actually getting a little soggy. Mm-hmm. So you can like raise your shoulders up, raise your head and neck up a little bit. You can also take one or two or three really slow, deep, energizing breaths. And these can be what I do when I feel this, is I will take a really slow inhalation that will take me maybe 8 seconds to just completely fill my lungs, bring it all the way in, and then I'll actually hold it for 15, 20 seconds or so. And I will feel that energy, that lung, that prana just like energizing my body. Then I release, and I'll take another really deep energizing breath, release. If I'm still soggy, then I stand up. I'll take one more approach. I'll actually just stand up. if that doesn't quite do it, I'll actually do a little walking meditation, you know, working. At that point, I've released a little bit of the open awareness of a formal strategy. So I'm mixing that with a little bit of walking meditation. You can also, this is a good place, if you know any of the Lujong body practices, the body training stuff, like, I don't know if you know those practices, Keenan, like the dignified dance of the Dakas and Dakinis. There's a one set of really wonderful physical practices you can do that are designed to bring up the lung. And then if that doesn't work, drop the whole thing and take a nap. But this is really, it's really common. It's almost like a yoga nidra type space that can be invited. And so what you're sharing is extremely common. And so that's why these antidotes, let me just repeat them. Raise your gaze, focus your attention, take a couple really deep energizing breaths. You can hold them, tighten your posture, stand. That doesn't work. Walk and then repeat. And then if that doesn't happen, there's also the really important principle of just fresh start. Drop the whole bloody thing. Let the whole thing go. Let your posture collapse. Let just throw the practice out the window. Just collapse, crash out literally physically for, I don't know, a minute or two, whatever, and then just start again. And then after a while, if those don't work, then it's like, geez, you don't want to go into a wrestling match here, because that's not going to help. At that point, I would just say, just drop the session altogether and then just start up again later. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I work with this practice a ton. And these are antidotes that I've read in the liturgy, in the standard instructions, and then also that I've kind of experimented with over the years for myself. So just keep at it. This is a really powerful practice.
By the way, is there any reference for the lung exercises that you mentioned?
Yes, there's a book by my friend Rose Taylor called Training the Wisdom Body. Okay. And there might be some YouTube stuff out there that she might have done by now, but she describes these quite beautifully in her book. And I do these all the time. There's a set of like 17, 18 exercises. Some of them are highly energizing. And I do these throughout the day, like when I'm down here in my study and I start to get a little soggy, I'll stand up and do one of these motions for 3, 4, 5 minutes, and it just completely gets the lung moving. Rose Taylor, Training the Wisdom Body.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cool. Okay. Hey, Mason. And then I'll see if there's anything in the chat column. Fire away if you're there, bud.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Was there somebody in front of me?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I thought I saw it. All right. I just had a question about... So it's a part in the Dream Yoga book, and it's when you're talking about Eastern techniques.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you go over the throat visualization technique, there's a part where you mention, you know, there's some people who get so advanced at it, they can, you know, just drop the, they can just drop their consciousness into their throat within a few seconds and you know, and then you mentioned P.D. Ouspensky.
Yeah, Ouspensky, yeah, right.
Yeah. Could you like elaborate on that more? What particular like practice he did, if there's a book that he
I can't elaborate more on what he did. I just don't know. I mean, I can elaborate a little bit more about the technique altogether. It's a variation of the wake initiated lucid dream approach, but I can't speak. Yeah. I can't speak with what Ouspensky did with it. But the idea is that according to what actually creates a respective state of consciousness is where these, you know, the bindus, like I write about in the book, these mind pearls, mind drops, they gather in these different energetic centers throughout the day. And where they gather, and this is in the Kala Chakra, it's in dozens of different tantras and all the inner yoga stuff, where these bindus gather, which they do spontaneously in what we know the waking, sleeping, deep dream cycles of sleep, they do that naturally. What you're doing with these inner yogas is you're actually engaging in this process that happens naturally. Now you're doing it volitionally. You're actually intentionally able to bring about these types of states of consciousness. And there's some very interesting, really accomplished practitioners who are now being studied in labs that can kind of do this. They'll tell the lab tech, say, hey, in 10 minutes, I am going to go into this state. And holy crap, there they are doing the metrics. They're all hooked up. And at the 10-minute mark, holy moly, man, this person has just dropped into Delta. And so this is not just rhetoric. This is just the consequence of really practiced minds and bodies that can directly do it. So you can either do it through an inner yogic approach, which is what the throat visualization does. Mm-hmm. Others can do it through purely so-called mental means. They can do it just through intentionality. But it's a more advanced, obviously, refined approach that, like I mentioned in the book, with some familiarity and proficiency, you can almost like, it's a slower version of it would be almost a type of auto-suggestion or self-hypnosis, where using a lotus through the power of association, you do the lotus enough that as you're working your mind around the lotus in the throat, associating these with the state of sleep, you can actually then, because it's a bidirectional process, right? You're associating the visualization with the phenomenology, with the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You can then use the visualization to invite the phenomenology, see? And then you can actually step yourself down. It's kind of graduate school level. I wouldn't tie yourself into knots about it, but you can definitely do it. It's actually part. Usually people who really get savvy at this are those who work a lot with the inner yogas proper, both mostly in the Buddhist tradition, like what I'm most familiar with. But anybody that works with subtle body systems can do this. And just to show you one kind of over-the-counter manifestation of this is people under hypnosis, right? Mm-hmm. They can raise their body temperature. All kinds of just seemingly absolutely astounding, miraculous physiological effects can take place, even in things like hypnosis, that are just like absolutely mind-blowing. Multiple personality. I mean, I'm super interested in dissociative identity disorder phenomena, MPD. What can happen physiologically to a person when another subpersonality takes over? It's absolutely astounding. I mean, one person, just to show you, again, the power of the mind, it'll put this in perspective. You can have a subpersonality come in that is blind and is paralyzed. Literally, you put someone from, they can't see it. Or you can have one that is allergic. It's just absolutely mind-bending what the mind can do. And so with some harnessing of the wind energies, proficiency in dream yoga, you can intentionally bring about these states of consciousness through these types of inner yogic practices. They're wildly esoteric for us. I wouldn't say they're commonplace, but they're not uncommon for really seasoned yogis. I mean, this is just kind of what they do. So I think it's cool just to put it out there. It's like, whoa, this is kind of interesting. This is inspiring. Maybe I can do that someday.
I'm actually in the, that's really fascinating because, I actually just moved to the Colorado Springs area. Do you know any like particular teachers or organizations that do train in like the subtle body, like stuff like that?
Let me think for a second. Tenzin Wangyal, the Bunpo, a wonderful master of dream yoga, he teaches on this. He does a lot. This, you can Google this. It's amazing. I hate to say it. But you can Google Tsalung, T-S-A-L-U-N-G. That's just Tibetan for Tsalung Tigle, the winds, the drops. And the channels. Anybody who works with the Tsalung practices, I know Pundarika, you know, Tsogyi Rinpoche a little bit. I'm trying to think of something that has like a formal curriculum. Tenzin Wangyal is the closest one. He probably riffs on this more than anybody. He's written a couple of books on this topic. In the classic Tibetan Buddhist scene, which is I'm most familiar with, these things are generally done under the rubric of the six yogas of Naropa. So that's another thing you could Google, because there are people who do that. The other one would be, he just published a book, Yantra Yoga. Alejandro, I can't remember his last name. He works with Namgay Norbu Rinpoche. So I'm just trying to throw some stuff from the dust bins of my memory in terms of like who's doing this actively now. That's what comes to mind, my friend. I'd have to spend a little bit more time to see who else is doing it, because most of the curricula that I was familiar with is no longer extant. It's no longer there. So the traditional training, the avenues that I was familiar with, they're no longer available. And so that's why these are the only ones that I can think of that work with this a little bit more directly. So I would start with Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, Namgay Norbu's main student, or one of his main students, Alejandro, I can't remember his last name. He wrote a book called Yantra Yoga, and there's a new one he just published. I think Shambhala Pub just came out with it. He probably riffs on it. Lama Willa may be doing something like this. Check out Wonderwell. It's either New Hampshire. I taught out there with her. She's really great. She just published a book. Reggie Ray does this a little bit. He doesn't do it as kind of overt classically, but he has a very interesting body approach that works with inner yogas. So the fact that you're in Colorado Springs, you might want to see what's going on with his scene, Dharma Ocean, because he's in Boulder and he used to teach a lot in Crestone. I'm not quite sure where the things are with his community, but he's another one that just came to mind that's actually someone in the hood that you could check out.
Okay. Ocean?
Yeah, Reginald Ray, Reggie Ray.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah, welcome, my friend. Okay, let me just see if anything came in the...
I sent you three that came in.
Okay.
At the bottom.
Oh yeah, Barry, preparing to die. Can we read that one after we finish dream yoga? Okay, if we live long enough, Barry. At the pace we're going with the dream yoga book, we'll probably be dead before we get the preparing to die book, right? But maybe that's another reason we should read a little bit more. Okay, so Francisco, who is the preparing to die course you mentioned just intended for? Anybody? This, Francesca, this course will be made available. No prerequisites, no special requirements. Anybody can take this course. So again, stay tuned. There's a lot to be said about this. For Barbara, at the end of my big interview with Ian Baker, he says that one has to be reborn as a male in Sukhavati. Yeah, that's not, I don't remember him saying that. If he did, it's not true. You're androgynous. There's no sex. That's one reason, interestingly enough, there's no suffering. There's one reason there's no suffering in Sukhavati, is because there's no sexual organ. So you're not born as a male. If he said that, that's not accurate, actually. I can't remember if he did, but if he did say it, that's not accurate. You're not male or female. You're androgynous. Oh, there it is, Alejandro. Oh yeah, thank you for pulling that up. Ralph, thank you, yes. Tenzin Wangyal, he was principally a student of Namgay Norbu. I didn't realize he was studying with Tenzin Wangyal, but he was principally the same guy we're thinking of. Let me see if I have his book here. I don't have it immediately available. I thought he was Namgay Norbu student. Anyway, let me see if there's anything else here.
I think you got everything from the chat, unless one was sent directly to you.
Yeah, it's looking pretty good. And we're about to sign off. Yeah, does anyone know, this is from Keenan, where the videos on the obstacles are? Keenan, they're way back. If you go to the webinar series, almost 2 years ago, there should be descriptions in the webinars. I did a fairly extensive riff on these obstacles there.
I posted a link in the chat too. It started with the webinar number 30, and I think there was 5 or 6 of them.
Aren't you the best? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Awesome. That's awesome. Okay. Oh yeah, this quote from Suzuki Roshi. This is the greatest line. Yeah, when you do something, you should burn yourself completely like a good bonfire. That's one of the greatest lines in that entire book. Well, everybody, hey, fun to hang out. It's been a while. Always fun to connect with everybody. So we do this totally geeky thing. If you want to do it, you can turn on your cameras, turn off your mute, and we can all give ourselves a group cyber hug. Until next time. So I'll be back in 2 weeks. If you're a nightclub member, you know all the stuff that we're doing on the nightclub site. Otherwise, in this more public, I'll be back in 2 weeks to take on more of these really awesome questions. It's so fun to connect with everybody. So until then, bye everybody. Stay healthy.
Bye.
Stay
healthy. Bye everybody. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, fabulous.
Thank you. Thank you everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
See you next time. Ciao, 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 everybody.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Night.